in matters of economics, everybody that is in any shape or way, shape or form involved in business has to try to learn from every depression. In those days, we used to have depressions more often, even after the big one of the 30s. And I think with each depression that we've had in this country, we've learned how to adjust and how to learn from one to the other. And I think the day can come when depressions will be less and less effective on the number of people that they have in the past. The whole banking structure, lately we've learned so many things the hard way, that savings and loan fiasco and so forth, that could have really plunged this country into a horrible depression if it hadn't been for a lot of the things that we learned from the previous ones. And anyway, if we're going to talk about economics, it'll take the rest of the day and then you won't get your next question.
Having lived through the Depression, do you think your political thinking changed or your values or beliefs changed over the years?
Oh yeah, very definitely.
In what ways?
In the ways of, on the liberal side of the fence, people have to help one another when there are troublesome times. And if you want to risk an anarchy or risk total disillusionment, you can't just ignore the lower end of the spectrum of the economic capability, the bread lines. You probably don't remember when they had bread lines and people were going hungry and couldn't get clothes, they couldn't get jobs. We have to have ways and means developed to counter these things and to lessen the burden, and we've got to increase our capabilities in having confidence that this is temporary and we can come out of it if we all work together. It all ties in my way of thinking, with the necessity that of eliminating the adversarial relationship between the unions and the industries in this country. Sure, we had a period when the pendulum swung all the way on the other side, when they had child labor laws and they took advantage of people working and paid them practically nothing, and sweatshops and so forth. That was that extreme. The other extreme is where the unions took over and ran the businesses. Neither one of the extremities work. And I think both of the extremities are aware of it now. So I would like to think that we've gained a degree of intelligence that will teach us generally speaking, none of the extremes are worth their salt, because they're extremes. And in matters of life and economics and learning, the extremities aren't the main thing. It's the mainstream that counts. And we're beginning to learn that. Even General Motors, with its headaches over the years with the unions, now the unions are a little bit more understanding and more cooperative. General Motors has a Saturn plant in Tennessee that does not have a union, and they're getting along fine. They learned from the Japanese how to work a little better with their employees instead of having the high muckety muck can't talk to boss in the top executive suite, where the bosses are working down talking to the workers and learning from them. And there's been a lot of real good results come from the experiences of of the General Motors and knowledge of how they do it in Japan and that plant in Tennessee. And I think it's been a big lesson that we'll never forget.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about your wedding day. You were married in Denver. Who married you?
Let me swallow my keyhole. There was a Rabbi Kafar, who was the head of a large Reformed temple there. You can turn that on if you want to. Or is it on?
It's on.
And here I was in the army, and Nan was out there visiting, and we went to him to talk to him And I told him all about what happened. And he says, how do I know that you're telling me the truth? Well, what do you mean? Why would we tell you that? Well, it's wartime. And he wound up calling my parents. He wound up calling her parents. We had to convince him that we weren't clandestinely in trouble or something and trying to get out or something. I'll never forget that, because he was really bullheaded, or overcautious, I would say, because of the psychology in war years, you know, and the psychology that followed, especially the era after the dastardly act of the Pearl Harbor, December 7th. And we had a hard time talking him into it. And then there was no time to get for any family to come out there. And we just had a marriage. He married us. And the folks all knew about it, and everybody in Marion knew about it, and we got telegrams and this, that, and the other, and the plan was still that as soon as we could get away, we'd come to Marion, we'd have a reception and so forth. And I had a friend of mine, I don't know if I forget his name, a friend of mine in the Army that was my best man, and it was just sort of almost like a next door to a civil ceremony, but yet we were married by the rabbi, and everybody understood, and we didn't know what was going to be. And interestingly enough, then I began to get serious about this fiasco of the Army putting me in a Cooks and Bakers school, and I started to. By that time, I began to know a little bit about the ramifications of Army and communication. So I got sent to Officers Candidate School in Florida, the early part of 42, and then came back home to live with her folks, because we hadn't, you know, we hadn't been married or established a home yet. And I was in Florida, in Miami, in a multi-level hotel with a no lights, and learning about everything officers learn about. I remember we had a judge that gave us a 1 week course in court martial activities, because every officer had to be eligible to be on a court martial, and one of the things he was talking about was rape. And he's a Southern judge, and he was with a thick Southern accent. And he says, now there, when it comes to rape, he says, there's two ways you got to look at it. Either it's rape or it's rape-oo. And then he went into the rape-oo, of course, was the two willing people, as opposed to the real rape. And but he spent almost a whole week on just little stories that he was telling about different cases he was involved in, and that was our legal training as an officer. Anyway, I don't want to get too much involved in the Army. We'll spend another day here.
How did you feel about serving in the military during those years?
After I had become aware of what was going on in Europe, nobody wants to go out and be a darn fool when it comes to serving in the Army, but I had no problems about serving in the Army at all, because I felt that the world had to wake up and recognize what was going on in Europe, and I wound up in the Air Force, not as a pilot, became an Air Force supply officer, and went to Africa and then Italy and other places in my military career, but I didn't have any strong feelings of resistance or anything. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to be a damn fool and risk my neck unnecessarily. But I felt that Hitler had to be destroyed.
Will you tell about some of your experiences during the war?
Well, if you think that's germane and you think anybody would want to hear about it, I suppose I can resurrect a few. Our unit, well, let's start after I left OCS. It's sort of interesting. We went to the West Coast to Oakland, California, where we sort of finished our specialized training in air service command activities, bombsite repair units and engine repair units. And I wasn't being trained as a mechanic, but I had to know what was being done and who was doing it and how to pick the right people to do the right job. So shortly after we got there, which was already toward the end of 42, our unit was put on a hot list, and we were given a unit identification number. Ours was 1540Y. That became our recognition for the kind of a unit we were, the 83rd Air Service Squadron, and we were sent to Everett, Washington, to bivouac, which was the first deep training we had had in living in tents and living away from civilization. And it was a pretty wet, yucky area we were in. It had never been prepared for anything. It was done on a spur of the moment, and it was muddy from the raining and everything. But it was a good experience, and then we were given top priority to, you see, we were in Florida, and we went all the way to the West Coast. Then we got our training and our bivouac, and then we were given high priority to go all the way from the West Coast to the East Coast, to New York. Well, I was pretty lucky. I was the Air Corps supply officer whose responsibility, among other things, it was to make sure that we had all the necessary essential equipment for our unit, because when it became hot, it means that you could be sent overseas at any time. I don't know how much you read about the war. You probably don't remember too much about it, but I don't know what you read about it. But I remember when the French, the Vichy French, were eliminated from the Morocco area. And anyway, our unit became a hot unit, and we went to Morocco to Casablanca, our first visit. Our first overseas landing. But I was pretty lucky in our wartime training, because when our unit was all loaded on cars, flat cars and rail cars, to go across the country, it was a pretty long trip. So their training continued from the standpoint of our unit cooks did the cooking for the outfit on the... But I got to go ahead and fly into New York to be putting together our supply list. And I didn't know anything about an awful lot of this equipment. For example, the one thing I remember that will be interesting is that our supplies for an air service squadron, and we were an air service for fighters, frontline mobile, move fast. The Corps of Engineers would come up and lay down steel mats in a cornfield, and we would move forward as the troops did. We were short on one of our four vans. You have four big vans, and one of them was a bombsite repair, one of them was a sheet metal repair, one of them was an engine repair, and one of them was Air Corps supply parts and material. We were short a fifth wheel, and we were short a fifth wheel, which meant to me that, you know, how can we go overseas without a spare tire? What's a fifth wheel? I don't know. No one bothered to tell me. And I went to the commander of the port there and went with our papers. And I was, in the meantime, living in the Pennsylvania Hotel. And there's another little interesting story here where Nan came to visit me. When I arrived at the Pennsylvania Hotel in New York, I didn't know anything about New York, and we already talked. And as soon as I found out that I was going to be there for a while, she came to New York, and we got to spend a few days there, which was very nice. But when I arrived in New York, believe it or not, it was raining cats and dogs, and I'm in the Pennsylvania Station, having arrived on the Pennsylvania Railroad from Marion, Indiana, because when I flew from the West Coast, I got to go home for a couple of days. And like the dummy I was, but nevertheless, I was in uniform. I go and ask for a taxi cab to go to the Pennsylvania Hotel. You remember anything about the Penn Station and Pennsylvania Hotel? The Penn Station is in the basement of the Pennsylvania Hotel. This guy drove me around for $6 worth and let me off in front of the hotel. A young man in uniform, and I'll never forget that. I just wish I could remember his face a little more clearly so I could tell why he did that. I couldn't figure it out. First of all, a taxi cab has all the business it wants when it's raining. And here I am, obviously a dummy who doesn't know that the hotel is upstairs, and I want to go to the Pennsylvania Hotel, and he lets me get my luggage and get in a taxi cab and drove me around for $6, and I gave him a dollar tip, and it wasn't until the next day that I realized that he took me from the basement to the first floor. You know, how do you figure out, how do you rationalize something like that? Anyway, getting back to the Army and my need for the fifth wheel, I call long distance at the Port Commander's Authority to Wright Field and told them, look, I said, we're not going to take these four units overseas without spare tires, and we're a hot number. I gave him the number, the code number, and he determined we are hot. The unit's on the way coming across the country. That'll be in New York in the next day and a half. And they shipped by Railway Express an extra wheel, which must have cost the government about $150 just to ship it. I said that wrong. I said a fifth wheel. All four of our units were short the fifth wheel. So I had four spare tires and wheels sent. You didn't change the tire in the Army when you had those big, great big tires, because you can change the wheel faster than you can change the tire. And it wasn't until after these spare tires and wheels arrived, and I went and checked them out and found out which warehouse they were stored in and signed in for them and everything, that I found out that, my God, I looked at our vans in there in the warehouse, and then checking everything off, I got to know where it is, and so I'll be sure that we get it with us. And I see that all of our vans have spare tires and spare wheels. And I look at my list again, and we're short the fifth wheel. And I go to some staff sergeant or some kind of a sergeant. I forget for sure what it was. And I said, look, son, I've got a problem here. What is the fifth wheel? Isn't that the spare tire? Oh, no, he says, the fifth wheel is that big disc that the van sits on the tractor. It's the pivot wheel. So I go back to our vans, and sure enough, there is no pivot wheel on the back. So I get on the telephone again, and I says, we don't have a pivot wheel. I call, what's a pivot wheel? What's our fifth wheel? He didn't know anything about the episode with the spare tires. We were the only outfit in the Army that went overseas with two spare tires. We were with, because I was such a schmaltz. But that's the way we were fighting that war in those days. And I was worried to death, how were we going to win this war with such inefficiencies? Until when we finally got to Italy and we had some German war prisoners assigned to us, I found out that they were just as blundered as we were. Yeah.
Really?
Anyway, our outfit landed in Casablanca after a very rough Atlantic crossing. And we arrived there about 2 o'clock in the morning, and we marched to the airport in Casablanca where we set up our tents and bivouacs and everything. We were in Casablanca probably for a good 6-7 weeks. You remember, have you read much about the war at all? There was a battle of the Kasserine Pass as you go up through Algeria to Tunisia. That happened within about 2 or 3 months after we arrived in Casablanca. And our kind of a air service unit was put up forward emergency fields because if the we had to have an emergency service for crippled aircraft and a place for forward takeoff, so they had more flying time with their fuel. And we had all the repair shops and everything there. So we come across one place on the way across from Casablanca to Tunisia, without going into too many stop-offs and details, which would take too long. But we came into Algeria, where it was spring already when we got there. And the place we picked for a bivouac, to set up our forward base, was a cornfield and a wheat field, mostly wheat. And the farmers had already planted their crops, and we wanted to maintain good relationships with the populace. So we called the council and got the French government officials to come in with us and help us interpret and negotiate. And we paid the farmers what they would ultimately get from these crops if we wouldn't go in there and set up our airfield. Well, how could they fight that? We paid them whatever the best crops would have brought them. And we set up our operations and continued our training. And we were performing well, and we had big oil dumps there, which an oil dump, fuel dump, is 50-gallon drums. And you couldn't put it all in one place, because if someone got in there and destroyed it, why, you had to have several of them, you know, because far enough separated that one wouldn't ignite the other. I mean, actually, the Arabs used to still come in there and get one little hole about the size of a large nail into one of these drums and steal a gallon of gas, and the other 55 gallons would leak out on the ground. And when they used aircraft 100-octane gas in their trucks, they ruined the engines anyway. But that's the kind of problems you had over there, and there's not much you can do about it. But we were still there in the fall before these key battles were fought around Tunisia, where give us a chance to move forward. And all of a sudden we realized that this wheat that was growing out around through and over our dumps was getting ripe and ready to harvest, and therefore a fire hazard. And we talked about it, and we realized that we're going to have to be there for another month or two, at least, maybe 3 months. And it was already beginning to become a terrible hazard, because you start one fire and it's all wheat fields that are all dried out, you know, and we could be destroyed. So we called in the same farmers we had negotiated with, and asked them if they would like to harvest the crops that we bought from them. And they looked at us like we were crazy. But on the other hand, how could you get a better deal than that? They paid us for it, and they're going to give it to us, the crazy Americans. So they came in and they harvested all of that wheat and all of that corn. Well, they were so grateful for that, they decided to have a big party for the American officials, who were so nice to them. And they brought in big tents and sent out big carpets and everything, and started and arranged a show with some Arab stallions, Arab riders riding these moving-like horses galloping over the sands, and then the banquet night they had wines, and they had roasted lamb and all the other stuff, all on one great big platter, no forks, no knives. Everybody reached in there and broke off a piece. We don't know how long it had been since any of them washed their hands, but you don't insult these people, so we all the officers were invited, and we had a big celebration evening, and telling you, we had more diarrhea in our outfit the next day than we ever did at any one given time in the whole war. But it was a great party. I think I've even got a picture of me riding one of those stallions. They had some wonderful horses there, and of course, riding over the sands, they the feet grabbed hold. Anyway, from there we went on to three more stops, and we were parked for a while in Bizerte, in Tunis. Tunis and Bizerte were very close. And Bizerte was in North Africa, that's part of Tunisia, became our central naval operations headquarters. All the way coming across Africa, we didn't have any fresh meat or anything that required refrigeration. We had to eat canned rations and everything. And I got together with the mess officer, and we went to the to get acquainted with the Navy people, because we knew they had huge walk-in cooler and freezer ships and refrigeration ships, and we traded them some Air Force jackets for a couple of roast beef and steak dinners that only you get from the Navy. It really, really took all the edge off of all the hardships we had in coming across Africa, but that's the way things were done in the war years. Nothing was done with any thought toward economy or economics. We even took some, found a place in Tunisia where we could get ice cream and watermelons and stuff like that, and got it for our outfit. And then it came our turn to go across the Mediterranean, and we went across in a very rough seas, and half the outfit was hanging over the rail stick, and I didn't have a bit of trouble. Before the war, I had been in Florida and went deep sea fishing and got so sick I thought I was going to die. I was afraid I wasn't going to die, I was so sick. And then when I went overseas, I thought I was maybe susceptible to this, but fortunately I never had a bit of trouble. There's another sequel to this, though, after I get home after the war. But we land in Africa, in Italy, in the boot of Italy. And by the way, before I left Tunisia, a doctor friend of mine, Dr. Gans, who lived a few doors from us, had come into that Tunisian area from the other side. He was came in from the Middle East side. And we met there and had quite a nice meeting, and wrote home to his wife and my wife. And they had a big party and married to tell all about it. His outfit was a field hospital unit, and they moved up into Italy, and then, as luck would have it, our unit wound up being about 40 miles north of them into a little town called San Severo in mid part of Italy. And we had a rather frightening experience up there, which was probably the closest I came to being exterminated in the whole war, and that was that we were serving primarily fighter planes and small aircraft, and we got a radio signal from a B-24 bomber, which had their bases below Rome in the southern part of Italy, and they had three of their engines shot up, and they had injured on board, and they had to come in for an emergency landing. Could we possibly handle it? And we said, no, but come on in. What choice have you got? And we were in an area where we had the metal runways, portable move removal. And they came in their landing gear wouldn't come down, and they slid in over this with sparks flying and everything. And just before the plane came to a stop,